to plan to release a few Uyghurs within the United States. It was necessary to show that we would do our part, as we were also urging many countries around the world to repatriate detainees who had been cleared for release, people who could not be convicted of any crime. It was also not safe for them to be sent home to China. The proposal was met with political and media hysteria. Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman led this charge from the Senate, declaring jointly that the Uyghurs have radical religious views, which make it difficult for them to assimilate into our population. The uproar led to legislation prohibiting the transfer of any Guantanamo detainees to the United States, even to supermax American prisons from which no human being has ever escaped. This made it impossible for Obama to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Today, the Chinese government uses essentially the same argument as Graham and Lieberman to justify genocide against the Uyghurs. They have radical religious views, which make it difficult for them to assimilate into our population. Americans may find it uncomfortable to be compared to dictatorships that brutally kill their own people. But Americans also like to think of our country as the world's leader, a shining city on a hill that sets an example to the world. Why would we think it is okay for our country to kill people, torture people, and demonize immigrants and refugees, and then be surprised when other countries emulate those actions, build upon them, or use them to justify their own repression? How would history have been different if America's response to 9/11 had not been framed as a global war, with the mass securitization and reorganization of our government at home and extrajudicial detentions of individuals and the invasion of Iraq abroad? Pick one person's experience of the forever war: Mohammed Soltan. In 2011, Mohammed was a 23-year-old finishing up a degree at Ohio State. He'd grown up in Michigan and Kansas, sporadically interested in politics. An Egyptian-American, but by his account, more American than Egyptian because of the gulf and lived experience between the two countries. "For a long time," he told me, "I struggled between the Egyptian part of my identity and the American part of my identity. The struggle was tied to the absence of basic freedoms in Egypt, a country ruled by the iron fist of President Hosni Mubarak. Mubarak was a military man, the second largest recipient of American assistance in the world, on account of Egypt's peace treaty with Israel, a staunch ally of the Gulf monarchies, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. I had this far-fetched dream," Mohammed said, "that someday the Egyptian side of my identity could enjoy the same freedoms and liberties as the American side. And that dream became more and more far-fetched until 2011, when I'm sitting there at Ohio State University watching the protests break out on my iPhone." Mohammed flew to Egypt and joined the protesters in Cairo's Tahrir Square. He stayed for days, finding solidarity with other Egyptians who wanted their identity to be wedded to those same freedoms that Mohammed had lived in America. He was there when Mubarak stepped down in the face of the protests. He joined the chants, "Raise your head up high." And for the first time, he felt the American and Egyptian parts of his identity converging. February 11th, 2011. "It was the last time I felt a sense of unbridled idealism about the Middle East in the White House, because I knew that this was a moment that signaled Obama was different from other presidents, different from the big names in the administration, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Bob Gates, who wanted to back Mubarak. Ordinary people had toppled a dictator, backed by an American president, making use of American technology platforms like Twitter and Facebook for the purpose of mass mobilization. Mohammed stayed in Cairo to be a part of the new Egypt and to care for his mother, who had cancer. Then things went wrong. The young people who'd protested lacked any political experience. The interim military government that was supposed to manage a transition to democracy cracked down on the secular activists, a familiar target, and one that clarified the choice for the nation: the military or the Islamists. The Muslim Brotherhood emerged as the only viable opposition, sweeping to victory in the parliamentary and presidential elections. The new president, Mohamed Morsi, began to steer the country in an Islamist direction. The U.S. government, through muscle memory, was engaging with the military and intelligence contacts it knew best, while trying to find ways to nudge the Brotherhood in a more pragmatic direction. Then, the Saudis and Emiratis started pouring money into the country, paying protesters against the Morsi government, funding disinformation campaigns against the United States, casting America as a dangerous ally of the Islamists. In July 2013, Morsi was ousted in a coup led by General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. In one of the most demoralizing experiences of my time in government, Obama decided against calling it a coup, which would have put that assistance relationship at risk. Parts of the U.S. government had never been comfortable with Morsi anyway, even if Obama himself had welcomed his election and tried to work with him. The U.S. intelligence community doesn't like an upended status quo. The U.S. military didn't want a rift with Gulf Arab allies. The U.S. Congress was deferential to an increasingly autocratic Israeli government, which saw Muslim autocrats as preferable to, and more predictable than, the Muslim public. By the time of the coup, Obama himself seemed resigned to the reality of a hard world. In 2 short years, the tide had turned from popular mobilization to authoritarian mobilization, from revolution to counter-revolution. Even the technologies that had seemed so promising were reverse-engineered and turned into means of disinformation and suppression. Mohamed went back into the streets to protest. "I didn't mind if Morsi left through a democratic mechanism," he said, "but I definitely wanted it to be through a democratic mechanism and not a coup." He started talking to Western reporters. He wanted, he said, to let them know, "Hey, I'm this American kid who is here. I don't believe in this mumbo-jumbo Sharia stuff, but the military coming back in this way is not right. This is against everything I've been raised to know." Mohamed speaks hurriedly, as if eager to get to the next point. Perhaps I couldn't help but think, the habit of a man who had been brutally imprisoned for a time, who once never knew if he could indulge in conversation again. On August 14, 2013, Mohamed joined a mass demonstration in Cairo's Rabah Square. The crowd was intent on staying in the square to protest the authoritarian turn of the new military government, repeating the tactics of Tahrir Square. This time, there would be no restraint. The security forces were sent in to clear the square, and Mohamed was shot in the arm as he live-tweeted a crackdown that killed more than 1,000 people. 11 days later, he was arrested in his house. The Egyptian authorities took his American passport and used it to mock him. "You think this is going to save you? It's not." Mohamed was taken to prison. He was beaten on his bullet wound. He asked to be taken to a doctor to operate on his arm. Instead, he was forced to lie on a dirty mat while a fellow inmate operated on him with pliers and a straight razor. There was no sterilization or anesthesia. Other prisoners had to hold him down. He was held in an underground cell, unable to see sunlight. He was beaten with whips, batons, and belts. He did months in solitary confinement. He spent much of his time on hunger strikes, protesting unjust detention, seeking the attention of the wider world, reaffirming the power of nonviolent resistance that had drawn him to Egypt in the first place. He lost 150 pounds. He developed an embolism in his right lung. He was warned that he could die. He was wheeled into court to appear in front of judges who sentenced him to life in prison. They tried to break him, to erase even his impulse for nonviolent resistance. They told him they were torturing his father, who had worked with the Brotherhood. Some days, the guards would slip razor blades under his cell door and tell him to cut vertically, not horizontally. "You can end it faster that way," they'd say. They threw a terminal cancer patient into Muhammad's cell and left the man there to die. Once he did, they left his corpse there. Even on his worst days, Muhammad held on to his belief in that story that had brought him back to Egypt in the first place. The idea that there are universal values and dignity in every human being. He believed that both the pathway of oppression and terrorist violence were dead ends, different sides of the same coin. His American upbringing had taught him that. The stability promised by Sisi was a fiction. The lure of violent opposition was a similar betrayal of his values. Yet his government was supporting a Sisi dictatorship that was clearly going to radicalize many young men who would succumb to the lure of violent opposition. Tor prison is the same exact prison where the Islamic Jihad movements gave birth to Al-Qaeda, that grandfathered ISIS. Those were the breeding grounds for those kinds of movements, he said. And he was right. Both Al-Qaeda and ISIS have roots in the torture chambers of Egyptian prisons. Egyptian prisons, Saudi money. That's how we got Al-Qaeda. But guess what, Muhammad added. Back then in the 60s and 70s, there were much better conditions than we have today, and a lot less people in there. While Muhammad was on a hunger strike, his jailers let ISIS recruiters in the prison, content to have their prisoners radicalized into the terrorists that the government claimed they were. They were actively allowing ISIS recruiters to float around the prison, whether it is to recruit or just to walk around with this victorious air that their methodology of might makes right is the only one that the world understands or pays attention to. That these nonviolent means for change simply don't work. That world powers are going to stand by authoritarian regimes, regardless of what's going to happen. That they will never be on the side of the people, and that people have to take matters into their own hands. This same story about the futility of nonviolent change was told by both the torturers of the Egyptian regime and ISIS. Both of these totalitarian systems need each other as enemies to justify what they do. At one point, an ISIS recruiter was put into Muhammad's cell and the door was locked. And so Muhammad Sultan, a kid from Ohio, found himself in the absurd, dystopian scenario of arguing with an ISIS recruiter who was enabled by an authoritarian regime that was ostensibly at war with ISIS. A regime that received billions of dollars in weapons from Muhammad's own American government, based on the idea that it was an ally in the war on terror. The two of them debated, there in the cell, whether Muhammad's hunger strike was futile. My rebuttal to him was, "They're not all the same," he said, referring to the diversity of Americans. "It's not all the same. It's not that easy. It's not that simple." Muhammad told the ISIS recruiter about statements from American leaders, from the White House, from John McCain, from others, calling for his release. "What kept the balance of good and evil in my head was that this wasn't my existence, that there were good people who'd never met me, and out of the goodness of their heart, their steadfast belief in values and principles, they advocated for me." Muhammad faced down the ISIS recruiters and the Egyptian regime through fidelity to an insight that he had about America and about human beings in general. "There's this perpetual cycle of good, just like there's a perpetual cycle of evil. So then I became more resilient." Statements of support from America that found their way to him helped water that seed and forestall the process of radicalization. Rhetoric slows down that process because it allows people to say, "Not everyone is the same. There's good people out there. Maybe we should be a little more patient." Muhammad refused to give in to his jailers. "I knew they wanted to break me, and I was not going to allow that to happen." On May 30th, 2015, he was finally released from prison and allowed to return to America. "All of that happened to me, and I'm an American citizen. You can imagine what 60,000 political prisoners in Egypt are going through right now, just for daring to have the same dream that I had, the most basic universal right to self-determination, to a dignified life. As a condition of his release, he had to relinquish his Egyptian citizenship, a part of his identity ripped away. The Egyptian government has a peace treaty with Israel. It is backed by the oil-rich Saudis. It casts itself as an ally in the war on terror. In return, the United States provides those billions of dollars in arms that are actually payments to job-creating American defense contractors, who then turn over their weapons to the Egyptian government. To America, all of those interests have been more significant than the interests of those 60,000 prisoners, or the absurdity of that same Egyptian government's trying to radicalize their own opponents to create terrorists in order to justify those billions of dollars in assistance. Such is the logic of our forever war. It is a logic tied to the reality that America's chief allies in the Middle East since 9/11 have become more authoritarian, from Saudi Arabia to Egypt, from Turkey to the United Arab Emirates. If I were a Muslim living in one of those countries, I would think that George W. Bush's stirring post-9/11 words could apply in reverse. What does America hate? It hates the idea of a democratic government in any of these countries. As an American, I find more hope in Muhammad's resistance than in Bush's words. He was more willing to put himself on the line for what America is supposed to be than America itself. How powerful that is. How hopeful. 8 years in government taught me a lot about the fallacy of control. I would sit in Situation Room meetings that were predicated on the idea that America had control over certain world events. The idea that if we continued to provide weapon systems to a guy like Sisi, we could exert control over his actions. The idea that if we armed a certain proxy group in Syria, we could obtain some lever of influence and manipulate events inside a chaotic civil war, like a mathematical equation. The idea that if we bombed a suspected terrorist hideout in Yemen, it would lead would-be terrorists in other countries to make different choices. The truth is that we controlled only our part of the transaction. If we provided weapon systems to a guy like Sisi, he would have those weapons. If we armed a certain proxy group in Syria, they would fight with those weapons. If we bombed a suspected terrorist hideout in Yemen, we could kill those terrorists. Obscured in those calculations was the wider impact of what we were doing. What example did it set for the world's governments and people if the United States gave billions of dollars worth of weapons to an autocrat, armed proxy groups in a civil war, and killed people in other countries? On one of my last days in the White House, I took a walk with Mohammed Sultan. We had struck up a friendship. And as I considered who I wanted to spend some of my final time in government with, I set aside an hour to meet with him. He'd been on something of an emotional roller coaster, and he wanted to channel his energy into pursuing structural change. He wanted to know how to reorient American policy away from the absurdity that put him in that prison cell with an ISIS recruiter. As we walked past the characterless 8-story office buildings of Pennsylvania Avenue, the law firms and lobbying shops that made money trying to influence the direction of government, we talked about the influence that Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates had on American policy. How they poured money into lobbying efforts, courtship of influential media, and the interests of powerful defense contractors who held sway on Capitol Hill and at the Pentagon. How the Republican Party had turned itself into a convenient domestic vessel for any hawkish anti-Obama view that legitimized the pursuit of more war, more support for authoritarianism. More fundamentally, how they deftly aligned their interest with the post-9/11 American orientation that was hardwired in the direction of fear. How America had been primed to be influenced to believe that more force against the terrorists, more confrontation with Iran, was the only logical course. Mohammed understood this mindset intuitively. He'd lived it. He referred to what I was talking about as a hyper-securitized narrative. In my own experience, this narrative wasn't just flawed because of the unintended consequences it wrought. With Iran, we'd just successfully controlled something, Iran's nuclear program, by making a transaction in which Iran had to abide by restrictions on its nuclear program. But that effort ran counter to the post-9/11 American view of the world. So despite its measurable success, the Iran deal proved to be far more controversial than the routinized aspects of the war on terror. The cycle of conflict and American-supported autocracy, the tens of thousands of prisoners in Egypt ripening for radicalization, the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran that was endangering millions of lives in Yemen. How do you change this narrative? Mohammed wanted to know. Part of it, I reasoned, was money. Investments needed to be made in supporting an alternative narrative with respect to our foreign policy, one that prioritized diplomacy and actual democracy. More fundamentally, we had to change something about ourselves. The hyper-securitized narrative, after all, wasn't just restricted to our foreign policy. It was the mindset where citizens had spent more than a decade taking their shoes off to board an airplane, where immigrants were regarded as security threats instead of potential contributors to society, where four American hostages murdered by ISIS received exponentially more media attention than a seismic shift in global influence toward China. An America where Donald Trump had been elected president. To change that narrative, we'd have to reckon with some truths about ourselves that run far deeper than any single foreign policy. 24. The ocean liner. Obama used to refer to the U.S. government as an ocean liner, a massive, lumbering structure that is hard to turn around once it's pointed in a certain direction, encumbered by the limitations imposed by Congress, the courts, state and local governments, media chatter, world events. This, he'd say, cut both ways. The genius of the system was that it limited the damage any one president could do. Trump, for instance, could rewrite Obama-era climate regulations, but those efforts would get tangled up in the courts. Meanwhile, Trump couldn't unravel all the changes that had been made over the previous 8 years at the state and local levels, or in the private sector. But the other side of that coin was what made government frustrating. Even with two terms, it's hard to do more than point the ocean liner in a particular direction, hoping that some future government will reach the destination. 8 years felt like a long time in the span of my relatively young life, but it was just a blip in time for the journey of the American ocean liner. After 9/11, Bush had pointed the ship in a new direction and generated an enormous amount of momentum. Wars launched, troops deployed, sweeping powers granted to the executive branch, vast new bureaucracies established, the Department of Homeland Security, the National Counterterrorism Center, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, organizational charts erased and redrawn, trillions of dollars spent. The entire apparatus of the national security state focused on this new mission of fighting terrorism. More fundamentally, the construction of that hyper-securitized national narrative. Our war on terror begins with al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. Despite the impersonal nature of the ocean liner, it takes human beings to make it run. I gravitated to the people lower down the chain of command, in their 30s, nearly all of whom had signed up in one capacity or another because of the attacks I witnessed in New York, the 9/11 generation. It was comforting to meet well-meaning people operating the machinery of the U.S. government, even if we were all uncomfortable with some of the things that machinery did. The Foreign Service officer who'd been kidnapped in Colombia and nearly killed by mortar fire in Baghdad, who developed a deep affinity for the minority groups in Iraq, caught in the crossfire of the sectarian war that America had unleashed. Christians, Shabaks, Yazidis. The intelligence analyst who'd once infiltrated white supremacist groups in the United States and showed me a picture of himself posing in the living room of a prominent white nationalist. The special forces soldier who never talked about his deployments and asked to be assigned to D.C. to finally be around his family and work on programs that benefited the young people from places where he'd participated in wars. there was a particular blend of idealism and disillusionment among this 9/11 generation. It was interesting to me that these younger diplomats, soldiers, analysts, and intelligence operatives had all developed a deep skepticism about some of the tasks they'd been assigned. Nearly all of them believed that the Iraq War had been a mistake, even though many of them had spent years of their lives contributing to it, and most knew someone, American or Iraqi, who died there. Those who had served overseas had developed an appreciation for America's limited capacity to shape events inside other countries, even as they also understood how large America loomed in the imaginations of foreign publics who experienced us as the unseen hand behind events, the shaper of markets, the provider of loans, the inventor of new technologies, the representatives of values we regularly betrayed, the narrator of what was happening in their lives. In Washington, this 9/11 generation was often out of step with the more established sources of power. The cabinet secretaries, generals, prominent columnists, and senior members of Congress who were too far along in their own journeys, too evolved in their worldview, too invested in the series of decisions that America had made to question the fundamentals. Mostly men who'd supported the wars, ignored the risks, and couldn't change their minds because doing so would necessitate acknowledging how profoundly wrong they'd been. About, for instance, why we were engaged in a multi-trillion-dollar global war against a constantly replenishing series of terrorist organizations that was eroding our democracy at home and sending all the wrong messages abroad. Many of these older people had been shaped by the end of the Cold War in the 1990s, when it did seem that America could do anything it wanted in the world, when it felt as if we had control. Yet there was a persistent idealism among the 9/11 generation, a commitment to make whatever difference you could, wherever you could. Resettling refugees who'd been displaced by America's wars. Negotiating a nuclear agreement with the Iranian government to avoid another war in the Middle East. Trying to catch up to the danger of climate change that was bearing down on us like a massive hurricane swelling off the coast. Negotiating an opening with Cuba to begin untangling 60 years of punishing sanctions and conflict with a small island nation, or less prominent efforts to help individuals trapped in the stifling circumstances of the wider world, programs to assist civil society in forgotten places, initiatives to get assistance to populations made vulnerable by famine or disease, sometimes on the fringes of the places where we participated in wars, advocacy to free people like Mohammed Sultan. America encompassed these contradictions, a force that broke things and tried to put them back together. I had access to all manner of secrets for 8 years. But the longer I was in government, the less important that information became. Inhabiting a paper flow of terrorist plots, intercepted conversations among government officials, and clinical reports on the political stability of this or that country increasingly felt like a view of the world through a particular securitized window. One that tended to reinforce whatever it was that America was already doing. This wasn't the fault of those who gathered and analyzed the intelligence. It was the muscle memory created by the direction they'd been given for decades. Budgets, reporting requirements to Congress, political pressures imposed on the executive branch. If you're asked to provide information on threats, you construct a narrative of threats. I increasingly sought out foreign voices that could give us a clear sense of ourselves. In Europe, I met civil society activists who were warning of creeping nationalism well before the refugee crisis of 2015, rooted in the post-financial crisis austerity of the European Union. Russian writers like Maria Stepanova could explain to me how Vladimir Putin had weaponized information against his own opposition in ways that foreshadowed what he would do to us. In Laos, a group of young civic leaders took me to the top of a monument in the heart of their capital city, an Asianized version of the Arc de Triomphe, befitting their French colonial heritage. In the distance, I saw a complex of office buildings rising above the surrounding structures. When I asked about it, one of the Lao said, with a tinge of anger, that it was a Chinese zone. You couldn't enter without a Chinese passport, even though it was in the heart of Laos. An image that said more than an intelligence report could. Despite my growing alarm about what America had done in the world, these warning signs cautioned against succumbing to the reflexive leftism that sees America as doomed to do no good in the world. If we were absent, then it would be only the Putins and Xis aiming to direct events. What would become of the European activists, the Russian writers, the Asians living in China's growing totalitarian shadow, Mohammed Sultan in an Egyptian prison cell, if America ceased to even try to be its better self? Sometimes, though, it felt as if we were spending all of our time trying to clean up the messes left in the wake of our own ocean liner. Meanwhile, others around the world were riding the currents of global events. Orban demonizing immigrants, Russian trolls sowing social discord, Chinese officials going to work in neocolonial outposts. Over the spring and summer of 2011, we began to have meetings in the Obama White House about how to bring the 9/11 era to a close. All U.S. troops were slated to be out of Iraq by the end of that year, and the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan had begun. Obama started to use the expression, "the tide of war is receding," which sought to signal a direction without being definitive. We were, after all, still at war. What was interesting to me at the time is that the very use of that expression drew the ire of the American right and elements of the establishment. To suggest that these wars should end short of the victories that had been promised at the outset was to acknowledge that the whole enterprise had been a mistake of almost unimaginable proportions. It also threatened the many interests that wanted to see the 9/11 era perpetuated, from American defense contractors to Gulf monarchies to Republican hawks whose political identity was tied up in the passions generated by a mindset of war against radical Islam. Obama's second term would become a tug of war between its desire to move beyond the 9/11 era and a constellation of forces, some real, some manufactured, attempting to pull him back. By 2016, the number of American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan fell to roughly 15,000 from the 150,000 who were there in 2009. But the infrastructure of the war on terror remained hardwired into America's overseas footprint. The Iran deal avoided another nuclear-armed nation or war in the Middle East. But the hyperbolic opposition at home contributed to the sense that we had to compensate for it by demonstrating our support for dissatisfied allies in Israel and Saudi Arabia. Climate change was made a leading priority in nearly all of our foreign relations in order to get the Paris Agreement done. But the infrastructure of government supporting those efforts was minuscule compared to the machinery dedicated to fighting terrorists who pose far less danger to the planet. And then, they were the tides that pulled us back into war. The rise of ISIS and the murder of four American hostages, which drew American troops back into Iraq. The pointless Saudi war in Yemen that could operate only with American support. These actions were most vociferously criticized not by those who thought we were doing too much, but rather by those who complained that we weren't doing enough. These substantive debates were, in retrospect, the less important aspects of how 9/11 was evolving in the American mind. The American people had been promised military victory in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. In Bush's words in that speech to Congress, the terrorists follow in the path of fascism, Nazism, and totalitarianism, and they will follow that path all the way to where it ends in history's unmarked grave of lies. If you watched Fox News, or consumed right-wing talk radio for most of the Bush years, you were always told we were on the brink of this victory, as surely as the Nazis were defeated and the Berlin Wall fell. But by the time the first decade after 9/11 reached a close, it was clear that America was not going to win these wars. What happens when great powers fail to win wars? Inevitably, there is a search for an enemy within. The force that stabbed the great power in the back or lacked resolve. This has been fertile ground for the emerging strongman, from Hitler after World War I to Putin after the loss of the Soviet Union. And so just as Obama was talking about the tide of war receding, the Republican Party was driving much of the political and media conversation into a toxic stew of issues that were simmered in the stock of post-9/11 fears and grievances. The charge that Muslims wanted to spread Sharia law in America. Obama's refusal to declare war on radical Islam. The antipathy toward immigrants seeking asylum at our southern border. The ceaseless outrage over Benghazi, a word that came to signify everything from a lack of diplomatic security in Libya to Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. This orientation spilled over into specious establishment debates seeking to pin the blame for the chaos wrought by America's war on terror on Obama's incremental efforts to end it, rather than the decision to begin it. If only we'd left 10,000 troops in Iraq after 2011, there would have been no ISIS. If only we'd kept sanctioning the Iranian government, they would have capitulated. If only we'd launched some cruise missiles at Syria after a chemical weapons attack, the sectarian Pandora's box of the Syrian civil war would have been shut. If only Obama more forcefully declared an unbridled American exceptionalism, the world would accept it. These currents merged and ultimately snowballed into a vast other that could be blamed for America's post-9/11 humiliations as surely as Putin blamed a constellation of domestic opponents for Russia's post-Soviet humiliation. This vast other could be interchangeably comprised of a black president, brown-skinned immigrants, Muslim refugees, and a shifting cast of targets. Generals like Michael Flynn and James Mattis, both of whom were fired by Obama, became symbols of the betrayed military men who could have defeated America's enemies if not for the weakness of liberal politicians. With the movement for black lives and advocacy for immigrant rights, the promise of white supremacy itself was implicitly cast as being at risk in a country with changing demographics. Propaganda outlets like Fox drove the overarching narrative. Social media mainlined pieces of it relentlessly into people's news feeds. Trump himself paid lip service to ending the overseas wars, but doubled down on the mindset of war. It was America first, and America's security obsession would be unleashed on this shifting assortment of villains at home. Despite all of these headwinds, by the end of the Obama years, I believed that the ocean liner had been pointed in a new direction. The wars were winding down. Climate change was being embedded into our domestic and foreign policies. Diplomatic initiatives from Iran to Latin America to Asia were coming online. Obama's personal popularity was high, which indicated majority American support for a different orientation abroad and a more liberal culture at home. The 9/11 generation was poised to ascend to positions of greater influence, drawing on the lessons of the previous 15 years. But while we had steered America in a different direction, we had been unable to repair structural damage to the ocean liner itself. We were moving in a better direction, but we were taking on water. In the second year of the Trump presidency, I attended a dinner of American hedge funders in Hong Kong. I was there as a guest speaker to survey the usual assortment of global hotspots. A thematic question emerged from the group. Was the Pax Americana over? There was a period of familiar crosstalk about whether Trump was a calamitous force unraveling the international order, or merely an impolitic Republican politician advancing a conventional agenda. I kept interjecting that Trump was ushering in a new era, one of rising nationalist competition that could lead to war and unchecked climate change, to the implosion of American democracy and the accelerated rise of a China that would impose its own rules on the world. Finally, one of the men at the table interrupted with some frustration. He demanded a show of hands. How many around the table had voted for Trump, attracted by the promise of tax cuts and deregulation? After some hesitation, hand after hand went up, until I was looking at a majority of raised hands. The tally surprised me. Sure, I understood the allure of tax cuts and deregulation to a group like that, but these were also people who clearly understood the dangers that Trump posed to American democracy and international order. The experience suggested that even that ambiguous term, Pax Americana, was subordinate to the profit motive that informed seemingly every aspect of the American machinery. I'd come to know the term as a shorthand for America's sprawling global influence, and how, on balance, the Pax Americana offered some stability amid political upheavals, some scaffolding around the private dramas of billions of individual lives. From the vantage point of these bankers, the Pax Americana protected their stake in international capital markets while allowing for enough risk, wars, coups, shifting energy markets, new technologies, so that they could place profitable bets on the direction of events. Trump was a bet. He'd make it easier for them to do their business and allow them to keep more of their winnings. But he was erratic and hired incompetent people, so much so that he might put the whole enterprise at risk. But it was a bet that enough Americans were willing to make, including those who knew better. From the perspective of financial markets, I had just finished 8 years in middle management as a security official, doing his small part to keep the profit-generating ocean liner moving. The debates of seemingly enormous consequence about the conduct of wars, the nature of national identity, and the fates of many millions of human beings were incidental to the broader enterprise of wealth being created. The war on terror was fine for business, so long as oil-rich states like Iran and Saudi Arabia fought their wars through proxies instead of directly. So long as the terrorist attacks by radicalized individuals utilized car bombs instead of nuclear ones. The rise of China was good for business, so long as gains from access to Chinese money and markets outweighed losses from Chinese theft of intellectual property. Trump himself could be good for business, doing away with taxes and burdensome regulations. There was a logic, I supposed, to seeing the world through this narrow window. Part of it was turning a blind eye to the populist radicalization of the American right that was necessary to elect someone who would continue to do something as unpopular as cutting more regulations and taxes for the wealthy. In the spring of 2008, I had to write a speech for Obama about the economy. The purpose was to walk through the deregulation of the Clinton years, to demonstrate that the structural problems in our economy had roots that predated the Bush administration's own spree of tax cuts and deregulation. The avuncular economist Austin Goolsbee walked me through a brief history, focusing on the Clinton-era repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had regulated commercial banking separately from investment banking, an effort that was fueled by $300 million worth of lobbying and that facilitated more corporate mergers, more risky bets, and more wealth concentrated among those who could reap the benefits. The growth of hedge funds and non-bank financial companies had then allowed the wealthiest to find new ways to get wealthier, through schemes that were unavailable to and not at all understood by the vast majority of Americans. The Bush tax cuts then transferred more than $1 trillion to the already wealthy, while creating deficits that Republican politicians could use to justify efforts to slash government spending. And of course, the unregulated subprime mortgage lending that was about to drag the global economy over a cliff, in which banks bet money they didn't have by packaging mortgages that Americans couldn't afford. As someone who worked primarily on national security, I remember being struck by how closely the excesses of America's economic and fiscal policy paralleled the excesses in our foreign policy. As a country, we'd spent nearly 30 years methodically designing a system that allowed people who were already rich to get exponentially richer. To what end? For what purpose? How had those in power not stopped to question the myriad consequences? When the bottom fell out in 2008, it helped propel Obama into the White House, but it also ensured that his presidency would be dedicated to cleaning up another mess in the ocean liner's wake. We lived a split-screen reality at the end of 2008. The explosion of hope that greeted Obama's election, paired with the free fall of the American economy. Charts with lines pointing straight down. Job losses over 500,000 per month. It was as if the fates had aligned to present Obama with an impossible choice before he even set foot in the Oval Office. Let the economy collapse so it could be rebuilt differently, or rescue it while preserving its fundamentally unequal structure. Obama chose the latter. Between the bank bailout he inherited, the actions of the Federal Reserve, and the stimulus he passed, trillions of dollars were pumped into the American economy to slow and reverse the fall. This helped avert at home the more painful and extended reality of the crisis that gripped Europe and other parts of the world, beginning an unprecedented stretch of economic growth and job creation in the United States. But it also preserved the inequality multiplying like a virus within our system. We would have only 2 years with Democratic control of Congress. During that time, Obama took frenetic action to point the ocean liner in a new direction. Obamacare, to enlarge the social safety net and give more people access to health services. A package to save the American auto industry. Competent management of the bailout to recover the public's money. Stimulus funding to plug holes in infrastructure and seed clean energy industries. Increased regulation of Wall Street to avoid further crises. Consumer protections. It was the most active 2 years of progressive legislating since the Great Society, cast as radical socialism by a rabid Republican Party. But it didn't change the fundamental nature of the ocean liner, the gap between the first-class cabin and the accommodations for everyone else on board. In 2010, turbocharged by the unlimited money that Citizens United introduced into our politics and the unguided missile of racialized right-wing populism, Obama would lose his Democratic majority in the House, and with it, any chance for structural reform. As the ocean liner moved beyond the rough waters of the financial crisis, inequality was the most glaring aspect of the global economy that America itself had done more than anyone else to design. Around the world, leaders on the center left seemed incapable of solving it. Leaders on the populist right at least offered an intoxicating cocktail of grievances and nationalism. If the whole game was rigged, then better to at least feel like a winner. In the years that followed my meeting with the hedge funders in Hong Kong, I found that people who worked in finance were often the ones who saw the risks in this money-centered dynamic most clearly. All this wealth, they'd say, it's just on computer screens. It doesn't exist in the world, not even in the promise of production and sales that corporations used to offer. Like the 9/11 generation I'd worked with in government, some of the younger people I met seemed conflicted about the system that they were a part of, but incapable of imagining how to change it. Wake up with the markets. Move money around the screens. Look for a slight advantage here or there. Hit your marks. Create return for investors. Make a living in the world as it is. A senior asset manager I met in Asia seemed to have arrived at a similar set of conclusions to mine through his own perspective of watching all that wealth move around computer screens over the years, albeit from a very different vantage point. We kept in touch, and he summed up how he viewed the trajectory of the last 30 years. There were, he said, three dividends after the end of the Cold War. A peace dividend, as the disciplining risk of nuclear war was lifted. An ideology dividend, as democratic capitalism vanquished Soviet communism as a competitor. And a technology dividend, as the internet expanded the boundaries of what was possible in the spread of commerce and information. Financial markets had gorged on these dividends, he noted, structurally blind to the inequality it was creating, the risks that were being taken, or the disruptions that lay on the horizon. When the bottom fell out in 2008, the steps necessary to rescue the global economy made it impossible to overhaul the global economy, because it required pumping an enormous amount of money into the hands of the very same people who had spent down those dividends. As if to reassure me that there was little that could have been done differently during my time in government, he pointed to the example of quantitative easing, a monetary policy designed by the Federal Reserve, and a practice that I'd occasionally have to defend at international summits. To stave off a global collapse after 2008, central banks, particularly in the United States, pumped money into the organs of the global economy to keep the body from dying. Trillions of dollars were transferred in part to the same big banks, Goldman Sachs and the rest, that caused the crisis, so that they could become a source of lending and investment. It worked. It helped prevent a depression and promote economic growth, but it also perpetuated the same structural flaws and inequities, the short-term pursuit of profit that ignores looming clouds on the horizon. Once again, there was an enormous amount of money sloshing around financial markets. Once again, the small portion of the population that was rich enough to have their wealth invested in markets also got richer. But for everyone else, the cost of everything from education to rent crept higher. The glass towers in New York went up, the old apartment buildings came down. With so much money funneled into the economy, there was excess capital, money that had to go somewhere because it made no sense for it to sit still. A lot of new technologies and platforms became a natural destination for this excess capital, whether that money was pumped into Silicon Valley startups or China's burgeoning tech sector. New economies were developed to service those with means in ever-changing ways, from Uber to Amazon Prime. Unburdened by antitrust laws that had been gutted, the monopolistic technology companies swallowed up their competition and in-person retailers. This helped tech companies grow faster than our understanding of what their technologies would do. There was an acceleration of the ways that technology changed how we consumed information, destroying traditional news media and replacing them with ubiquitous social media that vacuumed up the advertising revenue that used to flow to newspapers, magazines, and television networks. There was an explosion of data available to the technology giants who had billions of users, giving a few companies a degree of power that used to be available only to nation-states. They now held a vast blueprint of immense value to anyone who wanted to sell something or shape how people thought, from advertisers to propagandists. Meanwhile, people increasingly lived in self-contained bubbles of information designed to make them buy certain things or believe certain narratives. Swimming in profits, the tech companies moved to the next frontier, artificial intelligence, which will only accelerate the disruptions to industries, the displacement of workers, and the capacity to control what information reaches people, and what faceless corporations or authoritarian governments can know about them. The impact on human beings is almost impossible to wrap your mind around. But to this guy, the logic of how markets work suggests that the societal disruptions will only grow. Will China have the best model for the future, asserting more and more centralized control to manage disruption? Or can the United States find a way to manage the disruptions that markets are accelerating through our democracy? Or is it a problem without a solution, one that could culminate in war or revolution? I remembered one of the last meetings I attended with Obama overseas. We were in Lima, Peru, for a summit of Asia-Pacific nations less than 3 weeks after Trump's election. Before doing a town hall with a few hundred young people, Obama met briefly with Mark Zuckerberg. Facebook was a corporate partner of the summit we were attending. In the weeks since the U.S. election, it had become clear just how symbiotic Facebook's model was to Trump's victory. Cannibalizing traditional media that dealt in facts by posting unverified stories for free. And selling ads. Elevating conspiracy theories and partisan vitriol that traveled faster and farther through its algorithm. And selling ads. Serving as an open vessel for Russian disinformation that tore down Clinton and elevated Trump. And selling ads. Collecting massive amounts of users' data, which was in turn used to build a more efficient grievance-based campaign shaped around the likes and dislikes of users. And helping to elect Trump. We entered the room with the normal pomp and circumstance. Surrounded by a phalanx of armed Secret Service agents and advanced staffers, you felt a bit like gangsters strolling into a room, in this case, a fairly pedestrian gymnasium. But apart from Obama's entourage and cultural cachet, we were already yesterday. Zuckerberg stood somewhat sheepishly waiting for Obama alongside his aide, Joel Kaplan. He greeted Obama nervously, the two of them standing as Susan Rice and I looked on from a slight distance. It wasn't a formal meeting. Just a chance to catch up on the margins of a global summit. In this case, Obama's last. Zuckerberg had made waves by saying that Facebook had had no impact on the election result and expressing no regret for it. I listened as he backtracked slightly in his comments to Obama, making vague commitments to try to understand what they could do better. In a kind of paternal way, Obama encouraged him to do so. Then he started to offer specific suggestions. could Facebook do more to verify the sources of information on their platform? Even Wikipedia managed to have an open platform while flagging what information could be verified and what couldn't. As Obama talked, you could sense Zuckerberg and Kaplan reverting back to safer, more familiar ground. Zuckerberg spouting talking points about the openness of his platform and how it connected human beings. Kaplan trying to steer the conversation towards some future process they'd undertake internally. Wary of regulation, that was, to me, the only logical fix. While Obama prodded and offered to have his people share more information. It went on like that for a few minutes before both men had to get on with their schedules. "I hope he gets it," Obama remarked to us, walking away. I looked back at Zuckerberg, who appeared relieved the exchange was over, awaiting the debrief with his staff, the well-compensated people, who had every incentive to prevent him from questioning his own assumptions, the wildly out-of-date language about connecting people in an open internet. This reflexively defensive guy was a 34-year-old, worth $44 billion, the world's fastest-growing billionaire, and CEO of a company that was remaking the global economy, media, and politics for the worse. And he was accountable only on the basis of the wealth his company accumulated. There's something wrong with a society that produces that. When you leave the White House, you have a lot of lunches. Because you haven't had lunch in 8 years. Because you have no idea what to do with yourself. Because you need advice and people want to give it. In 2017, these lunches were set against the absurdist backdrop of the onset of the Trump presidency and his nascent efforts to take an axe to everything Obama had done. In these early months, I was just beginning to use whatever voice I had to rail against Trump and the forces that he represented. Nothing of great consequence. Tweets, television appearances, podcasts. Tiny pieces of real estate in the vast wasteland of American discourse. "Don't be too critical of Trump," I was advised. "You'll be taken less seriously by the shapers of conventional opinion. You'll narrow your options for future employment and government or the private sector. You'll attract negative attention from the Republicans who control the White House and Congress and seem willing to use their power to punish their political opponents." The fact that there was a logic to it made the advice more chilling. Even with a fascistic lunatic running the country, self-censorship was expected in how one talked about it. "Be critical of Obama," I was advised. "You need to demonstrate your independence, to reinvent yourself as something other than Obama's guy." I was familiar with this formula, as it had been followed by some of my former colleagues, including all of Obama's former secretaries of defense. But why was it helpful to criticize my former boss when the fascist lunatic running the country was blaming him for everything? I knew the litany of points that people wanted me to hit. We should have gone to war in Syria. We should have kept those 10,000 troops in Iraq after 2011. We should have been more robust in confronting Putin in proxy wars from Syria to Ukraine. I did have my list of things we'd done wrong. For instance, supporting the Saudi-led war in Yemen, surging troops to Afghanistan, or failing to more forcefully confront the Republican Party's efforts to undermine democracy. But these, I knew, were not the criticisms that most of the people I was meeting with expected to hear. To appear more honest publicly, I was being advised to be dishonest. I was struck in those early Trump years by the incentive structure of the American establishment, particularly in national security. If I wanted a future in government, I was better off keeping my head down and going to work for an investment bank or a consulting company than having a podcast in which I heaped criticism on the Republican Party. Even though Trump was an existentially disruptive force, there was still a whole system set up for people to paint within a particular set of lines that had no relevance to an administration that respected no lines. This whole dynamic was reinforced when Mohammed bin Salman traveled across the United States in early 2018. By that time, it was clear that he was a brutal dictator, imprisoning his own family at home, waging an increasingly out-of-control war in Yemen, briefly kidnapping the Prime Minister of Lebanon, lavishly supporting autocrats across the Middle East. Yet he was fully embraced, not just by Trump, but by every element of the American establishment. To his credit, not by Obama. He arrived to puff pieces from leading American columnists about how he was a reformer and a modernizer, Here he was at the New York Stock Exchange or having coffee with Mike Bloomberg. There he was meeting with bipartisan leaders in Congress. Here he was meeting with big tech executives in Silicon Valley. There he was meeting with the heads of Hollywood studios. He may have been a brutal dictator, but he had bottomless cash and supported the war on terror. Those were America's preeminent interests. It's no wonder he felt a sense of impunity. A few months later, Jamal Khashoggi, an outspoken critic of Mohammed bin Salman and a journalist for the Washington Post, would be chopped up at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Of course, there was also validity to all the advice I received. The more I moved into the lane of being yet another voice criticizing Trump, the more I slid into a chorus that predictably responded to his daily offerings of outrage, another anti-Trump grifter profiting off the reality show. It was also true that I could fall into the trap of becoming a mirror image of the Republicans I criticized, a tribal voice that assigns all blame to the other side. There was a legitimate need to wrestle with the errors of the Obama administration, particularly given that it ended in the Trump presidency. I was asked about this repeatedly and pointedly when my memoir came out, particularly in Europe, where journalists were trying to make sense of an America they thought they knew. Shouldn't Obama have bombed Syria after his red line was crossed on chemical weapons? Did Obama do enough to appeal to white working-class voters in West Virginia? I understood the impulse, but I had a hard time seeing how these arguments arrived at the core of what was at stake in America and the wider world. The white voters in West Virginia hadn't voted Democratic in decades, and by the end of the Obama presidency, we literally couldn't penetrate the right-wing information ecosystem they lived in. If we'd gone into Syria, Trump would have used that against us to great effect. I could see the structural issues that went unaddressed in the Obama administration, particularly on the three issues that loom so large throughout this book. We didn't change the fundamental nature of the American economy and the inequality it produces. We didn't do more to end a war on terror that radicalized American foreign policy and politics. We couldn't control the accelerating disruptions emanating from social media platforms that were killing traditional media, spreading disinformation, and hermetically sealing Americans inside information ecosystems. But I found it hard to see what Obama could have done to achieve fundamental change, particularly in the absence of any Republican support after we lost control of Congress. He could steer the ocean liner, but he couldn't rebuild it. More fundamentally, when it came to Trump and his election, the focus on Obama obscured, to me, the radicalization of the Republican Party that has been underway since the end of the Cold War, and that accelerated under Obama, a party that could find common cause with the likes of Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin by the end of our administration. Obama had not governed as a radical. Indeed, the things I wish he might have done differently are mainly policies that would have been further to the left and further antagonizing to the right. This, to me, cast a harsh light on a fundamental truth, one that is as uncomfortable as it is obvious. At one book event, I was politely grilled by an audience of Germans about Obama's responsibility for Trump. The red line and the West Virginia voter both made appearances. I reiterated that Obama came to office preaching national unity and bipartisanship. He extended olive branches far beyond the point when he had any reason to expect them to be accepted. His policies were more moderate than the progressive wing of the party wanted. He enjoyed broad support from a majority of Americans and would have beaten Trump if he could have run again. Finally, as one man kept insisting that Obama should have done more to stop the Republican Party's drift in the direction of Trump, I snapped, my voice rising just a sliver. I said that the thing that was most triggering to many Americans, that helped fuel the Republican Party's radicalization into Trumpian excess, that rendered necessary structural change impossible, was the fact that Obama was black, and there wasn't a damn thing he could do about that. 25. Fight the smears. When I was in my mid-20s, part of my job at the Wilson Center was to answer Lee Hamilton's mail. This mundane task introduced me to darker strains of American culture, conspiracy theories about everything from global governance to extraterrestrial visitations. During his 34 years in Congress, Hamilton had chaired the House Intelligence Committee and the Iran-Contra hearings, which made him the recipient of the occasionally eccentric piece of mail. Usually, these dealt with some dark aspect of the Cold War. In letters that ran 10 or 20 pages, often in meticulous handwritten script, people would detail the miseries of their own lives. Jobs lost, marriages collapsed, children estranged, and connect them to a suspicion that they had been the subject of some extraordinary plot. The individual stepping into history. In the quiet boredom of a slow day, I'd find it tempting to go down a rabbit hole imagining one of these letters to be true. The early 21st century internet already offering all manner of destinations to capture my American mind with investigations of the CIA's experimentation with mind control and LSD, explanations for Area 51, plots hatched by the secret societies of powerful men. The internet was the perfect host for conspiracy theories, offering a bottomless well of distraction from the minutiae of life, a community of believers, explanations for events beyond our control, what religion used to do. After the 9/11 Commission's work was done, I was an occasional contributor to an obscure foreign policy blog to which my email was linked. I almost never heard any feedback on my earnest musings, which tended to be concerned about wonky matters like NATO, nuclear weapons, and the efficacy of congressional oversight. Then I wrote a piece with a degree of snark about 9/11 conspiracy theorists, people who thought the attacks were an inside job. I linked to studies that debunked some of the more common allegations, that the World Trade Center had been dynamited, or that the Pentagon was hit with a missile instead of a plane. Within a few days, I received hundreds of email messages, people calling me a fascist, a murderer, a lackey for a shadowy cabal. I was shaken, having never before been the subject of that flavor of vitriol. It was my first personal experience with the sinister empowerment that the internet provides, the way it offers meaning and mobilization to lost souls, something to believe in, someone to hate. Early in the first Obama campaign, we confronted this swelling ecosystem through a phenomenon of forwarded emails and shared social media posts, missives that reached tens of thousands of people, alleging that Obama was a secret Muslim, that he wasn't born in the United States, that his book had actually been authored by Bill Ayers, a member of the Weather Underground. It seemed a comical diversion at first, not unlike the strange letters I used to read in Lee Hamilton's office. But the reach of these missives was so extensive that we started to arm our large network of field organizers with talking points debunking them. We called the effort Fight the Smears, a nascent defense against what we assumed to be the fringes of American thought. As Obama started to win primaries, the smears migrated to more mainstream platforms, right-wing websites, talk radio, and ultimately Fox News. It was as if the ascendance of a black man up the ladder of American political power was an unthinkable phenomenon, something that couldn't be explained by the simple fact that he was a talented politician winning an election, something that suggested more sinister forces in play. Something else must have been afoot. By the time Sarah Palin was on the Republican ticket, these fringe views had become the subject of dog whistles and pronouncements by a major party candidate for Vice President of the United States. Obama pals around with terrorists. Obama's not a real American. In retrospect, it's possible to see the perfect storm that was building. The way the inexplicable nature of an Iraq war based on a false premise and the collapse of the financial system hinted at some darker explanation, the innate corruption of elites. The way that the election of Barack Hussein Obama was similarly unfathomable to whatever vast swath of the population had been raised to believe in the inferiority of those who were black or of Muslim heritage. The way social media platforms prioritized the spread of content that captured people's attention and held it, organizing them into enclaves of the like-minded who believed they were discovering something essential and evil about whoever comprised the other. The way this became mainstreamed in the American right wing after Obama's election, as Fox's leading primetime personality became Glenn Beck, a raving lunatic who offered nightly explanations of nefarious and un-American plots being hatched by the administration that I was serving. Death panels to render judgment on the elderly, Sharia law that would be imposed on unwitting American communities,